for the love of language.
For the love of language. For the love of language.
Tonya, storytelling, as we talked about earlier, seems fundamental to the way we communicate and to language itself. But are there natural rules for telling stories? Does that come naturally to us?
I think all societies have a need to tell stories, but the structure that's built into how a person tells a story actually can vary between different cultures. And I think that's an important thing for everyone to know, because certainly there are contexts where there are big assumptions about what a normal story structure is. So when you're at primary school, you get taught how to write a narrative compared with the informational text, compared with the persuasive text, and that gives an incorrect impression of how universal those strategies are. And one of the ways that I know about this is because when I was working in Papua New Guinea, people had very different ideas about what the key pieces of information were that you needed to include in a story to make it understandable. So for me, I like to know when something happened. I need to know when it happened to be able to connect into it and imagine the whole thing happening. If I don't know when it happened, I don't really know how to locate it. But for the people I was working with, the Malis in Papua New Guinea, the main thing that needed to be established from their perspective was where something happened. And for me, because I was new in the community and I hadn't travelled very much in the region, most of the markers they were giving me to attach the story to a place weren't markers I could use. So I had two problems. I had not getting the marker I expected, and then the marker I was being provided with not being something I could use. Now, if I had taken one of those speakers and put them through the kind of tests that a speech pathologist in Australia would use to assess their ability to tell a story, they wouldn't do so well. But it's got nothing to do with their ability as a storyteller. It's all about the fact that the conventions that support the story have a cultural aspect to them.
Are there natural things about, you talked about time, place, spatial relationships, movement? It's almost like a triangle, isn't it? Space, time, movement. Are they lying right down in the bedrock of how we tell stories in language?
Well, they're all part of a story. There are things that happen, they happen somewhere, but which ones you foreground and how you introduce them and manage the transitions between them, those things are very culturally laden.
But Kate, I'm thinking the way you're responded to when you're telling a story, if you have a what we call a beginning, and we talk about a middle and an end, but if you start, as some films do, they start in the middle of a story sometimes, don't they? And that's unconventional. But are there some natural linguistic necessities, I suppose?
Well, I suppose if we're thinking about how we talk naturally, not just necessarily a narrative, but just our normal everyday talk, there does seem to be a fairly universal, it seems to me, I'm always very nervous saying universal, a way of packaging information, and that is to start with what's familiar and then go into the new. So there does seem to be a very, very powerful way of formatting or structuring information. And so that gives it a kind of a coherence.
When you have big chunks of language, like your book, For the Love of Language.
That's a big chunk.
It's a very big chunk. But then straight away, I flick through the pages, there's an enormous amount of organisation there, right down at the paragraph level, the way you've put it together, the word order, breakout boxes, all that sort of thing, all really quite linguistic, quite language-based. Are there things that kick in once you start expanding language and putting it into bigger and bigger pieces?
So one of the really important things for writers to be able to manage is something called the theory of mind. So when you're writing, you need to really be able to imagine the mind of the reader and keep in mind that they will know some things that you know too before the writing starts. But really, you have to be thinking all the time about what they know and what they need to know next so that you can take them on the journey or the argument or the series of events that you're trying to communicate in the writing that you're doing. There's a level of psychological insight that's required in order to communicate effectively in the context of writing.
A great example of that for me anyway is I've spent a lot of time working with journalism students, and particularly in radio, writing radio news. There's probably no tighter sphere of writing on the planet than radio news, because it has to be all the right word order, has to have imagery, or has to be very clear, and it has to be readable. All those things have to happen. So that's very much language at work, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. There are very many constraints there that students have to work within when they're learning to do that kind of writing.
I said it has to be readable, and I'm intrigued by that process, I've got to say, because You're looking at little marks on a page. Part of your eyes are flicking forward to the next couple of sentences. That's essential to be a good news reader. You're communicating, you're recreating some sort of ersatz social tone. So you're communicating, you don't sound like a robot. All that's going on and it's going into the eyes, going around in the brain and coming out very quickly out of the mouth. Meanwhile, bits of the brain are looking ahead to the end of the paragraph. So you're making prejudgments about intonation, flow, pace, stress patterns, etc. That's quite a complex process, isn't it?
It's a very impressive psychological performance, really, when you get down to it. There's an awful lot going on. And I think the fact that it's written and someone's reading is one of the things that make the rest of the task more possible, because if you were also having to think through what you were going to say, you couldn't possibly sustain that level of speed to communicate that type of complex information. It reminds me a bit of simultaneous interpreters, right, where they're hearing and talking at the same time.
But that's also just thinking of our everyday chat. I mean, that's also impressive, you know, because we're having to, as we're speaking, I'm looking to see whether what I'm saying makes any sense to you or you're nodding and or not. And we're doing it at breakneck speed. And I get very, very cross when people get so irritated by our little pauses and hesitation fillers, etc., because that's a natural part of our speech. And if they're not there, then you ought to be suspicious of that person because they're probably quite well rehearsed.
Mm. Our vocabulary is like this great big box, isn't it, of things where we're looking for words. I have no idea how we choose those words ultimately, but I guess some are on offer as you're moving through the sentence and moving through a slightly more formal if you're making when you're lecturing, for example. You don't read at all, you lecture.
No, and it's interesting, isn't it, when people do read a lecture or they read a speech.
Yes.
It's very hard to follow as a hearer because you don't have the natural pauses or the repetitions and et cetera.
Flowing over the top of
you. Apart from the fact it's missing the kind of social connection.
And we don't get very many extemporizing speech makers, do we, that are really good at oratory, I suppose. Mm. So oratory and rhetoric is something, is that still a powerful thing in the world or is that becoming less common? It's becoming a more rare skill.
I have memories like nightmares of sitting in Year 7 English listening to people read out loud in class. So I think that part of what's happened is that whereas maybe 100 or 150 years ago for a certain class in society, reading out loud was almost a recreational activity and a thing that people sometimes invested a lot of effort towards art in doing, the kinds of social ways we've read to each other more recently have been very restricted. And so people don't get the practice. There's not opportunities really to learn how to do that.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Words like oratory or rhetoric or oration, I mean, they're just words you don't hear anymore. I think many younger speakers probably wouldn't know what they meant.
Or Barack Obama was an orator, wasn't
he? Yes.
But he was a rare bird these days. What is the role of linguists out there in the real world? We think of linguists as academics, Tonya and Kate, but we know that someone like George Lakoff, whom we've referred to, is very active at the moment in American politics, putting out a template, a model, a paradigm, if you like, for the way to interpret Donald Trump's tweets, for example. He's laid it out in very clear linguistic language. We know there are forensic linguists these days as well who sort out aspects of language to identify authors. So let's talk about the linguist out there as an activist and as a forensic worker, if you like. How does linguistics intersect with that world?
Linguistics has feelers into many, many different areas, and you will find linguists in, yes, quite surprising areas. I know that people seem surprised when they hear the word forensic linguistics, and yet many of my colleagues, and certainly I've been involved in cases of language in the law where, in fact, been brought in trademark dispute, for example, or in stylistic analyses. Linguists are being used now to look at students' essays. You know, you might ask the student to write a bit of language down in the class and then compare that with a later essay to see whether that essay might have been bought on the internet or not. So, yes, there are interesting intersections of language in the law. Did that person write the suicide note or not, you know, or was it written by someone else?
It really goes back to the idea that language is rule governed. And so, you know, not only do we have our personal patterns and repetitions, but also across the way language is structured in general anyway, there's rules. So if you have a system that can do a good job of pattern matching, it makes it quite efficient to look for things that have the same pattern, whether it's identical text that's been taken from a book and put into an essay, or whether it's, you know, different bits of communication by the same person. It's pattern matching is a really important part of what's happening.
I know there's been a fair bit of linguistic analysis of advertising, which lies at the other end of the spectrum, doesn't it? We're talking about great chunks of language, but then there's that real skill in creating a three-word or a four-word slogan that's memorable, that's relevant. The one that springs to mind that's always mysterious to me is the one for the Commonwealth Bank in Australia. The slogan is, "Which bank?" How do we arrive at two words like that? It was a very successful advertising campaign, but linguistically, how do you approach that? How does that work? How does that memorability become encoded in those two words? What do linguists say about that?
Well, it is a good little soundbite, isn't it? It's very short. It is memorable. You've got the which draws attention to it.
It's a question.
Yes, yes. So I remember that much more than, say, the listening bank. And there were all these other slogans that banks used to have. But that one, that which bank, really did stick. And that's indeed where linguists can get jobs. Certainly there were linguists involved in the naming of PowerBook, for example, or BlackBerry. Two very interesting trade names, but they had linguists there brainstorming what we were talking about earlier, sound symbolisms, the meanings that are associated with certain sounds, the meanings that people attach to certain sounds. I remember speaking to one of the linguists who was involved in it. They were surprised with the agreement of the meanings that people were attaching to those voiceless stop sounds, for example, that we were talking about earlier. Remarkable agreement there. So PowerBook was a very good name for something that was compact and dependable, because of the certain assemblages of consonants there particularly.
You can see how that's a useful thing to know, can't you?
Yes.
Finally, in this discussion on language at work, there are two phrases out there in the political world, in political discourse, which are like Exocet missiles. One that you know well, Kate, is political correctness, which has a whole history, a whole backstory, doesn't it? It's gone from right to left to right, and different ends of the political spectrum have used political correctness. It's a shape-shifting sort of phrase too, isn't it? It's really changed in its attack.
I notice people, when they use it, they usually say so-called political correctness, and they do it in these sort of mental scare
so-called
quotes.
So-called political correctness. But it can be very savage, very belligerent as a phrase, and used in a very attacking way. Mm. The other one, which I find quite off-putting, is virtue signalling. One group will say, oh, you're just virtue signalling when you bring up a policy.
I think it tends to mean that you're raising an issue or communicating a stance in relation to something that you may not actually put a whole lot of your back into.
That's the implication, but it's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
It's a way of expunging any sincerity in your opponent straight away in two words, virtue signalling. So there are a whole lot of these little Exocet missiles in language at work, aren't there, where you can, in two words, three words, create a very strong sense of attack. So, Tonya, even if we're just talking about two words like political correctness, behind all that is quite a lot of structure, I think. But the big speeches and the big interviews and the big chunks of language are really dependent on structure and organisation in language at work. How has that evolved over the history of language?
It's interesting to think about how writing styles have changed. Henry James, for example, an author back in the Victorian days, he has sentences that go for paragraphs. If you did a ratio of commas to full stops and you compared his work with the work of someone who writes in our day, he'd have way, way, way more commas than what people use now, because he had very, very, very long sentences.
And clauses.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting to me about that is that when I've attempted to read those novels, I can't read them the way I read modern text. I have to slow right down, because you don't get a whole idea unless you hang on to everything in that big, big, long sentence. It's actually a much more complex thing that happens as you read.
It's more like a Chinese box of a sentence, isn't it? There are lots of, and I must say at school, and here we're going to date ourselves again, not only did we learn how to write those very long sentences, we knew what each clause was. It had a name, the style of clause that it was, and how it actually fitted into the Chinese box of a sentence. And I guess the question then is, does a long sentence like that have a very different power about it linguistically compared with the Ernest Hemingway effect with short, sharp sentences?
It does, but you know, like, I was in a book club, and that's why I was reading Henry James, because I wouldn't have done it voluntarily. Although I did find ways to appreciate it. But most of the other people in the book club didn't make it past chapter one, because the skills that you need to read it are different. And I'm not saying they're better or worse, I'm just saying they're different. And you become habituated into particular kinds of communication, and you know what the strategies are to expect, and so you look out for them. And all of that routinisation makes communication much easier. So those structures are valuable. So when I was talking before about how people in different cultures might have different ways of approaching a story, those things matter. And so when you have speech pathologists measuring kids' ability to tell stories, they are measuring something important, because to be successful as a communicator in the workplace, you need to know how to do these things. So although it's important to acknowledge difference and value difference, it's also important for people to have the opportunity to learn the skills they need to function in different contexts.
Language change, it's our constant theme, Kate. It's what we talk about down at the word level, down at the pronunciation, the sound level. But it's true, isn't it? You look at a politician's speech these days, they're just all short, sharp sentences. There are no clauses there, very few qualifying or modifying clauses within their language. So is that historically, as we look at ourselves today, we've drifted away from that style of communication in language, and that's part of the evolution?
And certainly if you look at journalistic writing these days, it's so much closer to what we say, isn't it? Whereas in the past, you're quite right, there were incredibly long sentences. People just wouldn't put up with it anymore.
Because we're in the age of skimming and multitasking.
And the soundbite.
Writing doesn't have the same hold on our minds anymore, and speech is kind of broken away. And that's where, of course, change is happening. And we are now writing much more as we speak, so that's kind of blurring. As I think we talked about earlier, the rate of change is speeding up. There's no doubt about that, in all aspects of the language.
It's an exciting time to be a linguist.
It is exciting.
Until next time. For the love of language.